We'll hear argument now in the case of Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems against Estrella. Mr. Richard.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen Rychek. I represent Cronus Projects, LLC. May it please the court. This case involves a foreclosure sale conducted by the Special Commissioner Stephen Nagy in a federal, in a diversity of citizenship case. Most of the sales are done in the, most of the foreclosures are filed
counsel,
in state court.
We need to discuss at the outset the question why this case is here. How is the judgment entered by the district court, or the decision entered by the district court, a final decision under 1291?
Well,
this case isn't over.
Right, it's not over.
Well, since one can appeal only from a final decision of the district court, it doesn't look like we have one. This seems to be an appeal from an interlocutory order. It's like appealing from an order vacating a jury's verdict and holding it, setting the case for a new trial. Judge's order may be erroneous, but it's not appealable.
Well, Your Honor, the only case, you know, we have this case in the matter of Allen. It's a bankruptcy case, Seventh Circuit case, 816 F. 2nd, 325, which held that a order deciding validity of a foreclosure sale is a final order for purposes of appeal.
Yeah. In bankruptcy. Are you acquainted with Butterfield against Usher?
No.
The decision of the Supreme Court of the United States holding that an order refusing to confirm a sale outside of bankruptcy is not final and not appealable.
No, I'm not.
And a decision of this court is Levin against the United States, 513 Fed 2nd 92, written by an obscure circuit judge by the name of Stevens, holding also that these kinds of orders are not appealable. Awfully hard to see why we're here. It's doubly hard to see why neither brief discusses appellate jurisdiction, even though this is transparently not the district court's final order in the case.
Well, of course, it's a final order as relates to us, so I assume maybe the collateral order doctrine. But if those other cases, you know, there's another appeal I have also involving, and in that case, the Seventh Circuit has asked for briefs on the jurisdictional arguments. In this case, it wasn't asked for.
What's the name of that case?
I don't remember it often. I just don't have it at the top of my head. But there
is it the same situation?
More or less. It was a vacation of a sale. Or
same.
It was a denial of a confirmation of a sale.
Yes, and actually, I'm aware of that case, and we alerted you in that case. I didn't know you were the same attorney.
Yeah, I'm also involved.
We alerted you in that case to Levin and Butterfield.
Right.
So
correct.
I am shocked that you are unacquainted with Levin and Butterfield.
No, I said I'm acquainted with Levin. I didn't say I was not acquainted with Butterfield.
But Levin relies entirely on Butterfield. That's the authority for Justice Stevens's decision. You can't read Levin and not be acquainted with Butterfield.
Okay, well, then I apologize.
Well, is there any basis on which to distinguish Levin or Butterfield, for that matter?
Probably, Your Honor. Again, these are state-conducted foreclosures. This is based on the law of the state.
Completely irrelevant,
Your Honor. If it's a matter of procedure, then there probably is no basis.
It's a matter of jurisdiction. Whether there is a final decision within the meaning of 1291. Well, you're obviously unprepared to argue it. As I say, I hadn't known you were the lawyer involved in that other case. Mr. Noonan obviously doesn't have the benefit of our briefing order in the other case.
Yeah, he's involved.
So
also.
I will. Oh, he is also involved.
His firm
in
is also on the other side of that case.
Hmm. How long did we give you for?
We already.
Pardon?
I think that came out on the 20th.
Yeah, that was about 10 days ago.
Right, and we had to file our memorandums by Tuesday the 2nd.
So that memo's already been filed?
Correct.
Okay. Well, we will give you a very short time then in this case. We'll give both sides a very short time. We'll give you until next Tuesday to file a jurisdictional memorandum in this case, because both of you now have a leg up. But unless there's some way to distinguish Levin and Butterfield, it's awfully hard to see how we have any jurisdiction. Well, go ahead, counsel.
Well, I mean, should I bother to argue the merits?
This is your only opportunity.
Well, Your Honor, assuming you have jurisdiction of the case, this particular action was a foreclosure sale conducted at which my client appeared and bid, and at that point assumed everything was fine. Subsequently thereto, my client was made aware by the plaintiff and or special commissioner that the special commissioner had received certain instructions from the plaintiff as to how to conduct the bidding. And the instructions made it clear that the plaintiff was prepared to bid the full amount of the debt, but wanted to do it in increments, which then, in my opinion, creates...
Is there any provision in Illinois law that permits a creditor to conscript a special commissioner as his agent?
No, I cannot find any, and that was...
So why didn't Cronus send its own agent?
No, Cronus was not the plaintiff, you mean.
Why didn't Mortgage Registration System send its own agent?
I don't know, but the sale was conducted and there were other bidders. There were three or four other
bidders.
Your
client was the highest bidder, and for whatever reason, whether he's an agent or whatever, he stopped bidding instead of going all the way up, however high your client would have bid.
Well, my client
up
stopped.
Up to the debt.
Right. My client was not the person prepared to bid up to the debt. My client...
I know, but it was bid higher than whoever bid before him.
Correct. He was the highest bid at that sale that was conducted.
And maybe you wouldn't have gone up to the debt, but somebody didn't bid it up any higher than that. So your client would have gotten basically a windfall, I guess, which is why you show up at those things, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if he would have gotten a windfall, Your Honor, but my client appeared at the sale to bid, and it was after the sale that the plaintiff and the special commissioner together stated, well, I, the special commissioner, didn't follow the plaintiff's instructions by continuing the bidding. And it was shown in the instructions.
But, of course, if the special commissioner had no duty under Illinois law to act as your client's unpaid agent, what difference would it make?
Well, that wasn't my client. My client is the person that bid, that the plaintiff.
Yeah, I keep
right.
Confusing exactly who it is.
Well, I agree that they had no authority to bid. That's one of the arguments I made. And therefore, anything that happened in this case, any mistakes that were made, were really created by that situation where the plaintiff thought they had the authority to tell the special commissioner what to do. I mean, they should have come in and bid the full amount of debt to begin with, and that would have been no problem at all. None of us would be here, and that would be the end of the case.
Well, let's assume that the district court's conclusion regarding the mistake that we've been discussing is wrong. Wouldn't the district court's conclusions about this being unjust be sufficient reason to affirm the denial of the confirmation of the sale?
Well,
it's a very elastic standard, and a deferential standard of review. So
I agree. They have
swimming upstream on the merits.
Of course, in Cook County, they would never be making that argument.
Okay. I'm from Milwaukee County.
Well, they won't approve deficiencies in Cook County. But in any event, you know, I keep thinking back to what if the situation was that my client was sick. Supposing he woke up sick that day, and he called his friend and he said, why don't you go down there and bid for me? And then that friend made all kinds of mistakes that we could prove were prejudicial. You know, would the district court under those circumstances, you know, supposing he said, well, go bid up to $300,000, and he would, you know, didn't, and somebody else, or bid to a higher amount, and then somebody else got it at a lower amount, and then he walks into court and says, well, Your Honor, I was prepared to bid more, and there's more money now for the defendant. Would the court then set aside the sale? You know, who makes the mistake? I mean, really, does not promote stability at these sales when all these mistakes come into play. And in this case, you have a situation where the plaintiff wanted the special commissioner to do his bidding, said, you know, he became nothing more than a bidder. I mean, certainly he could have just walked in there and said, I bid the full amount of it, that $306, which he was prepared to do. Instead of that, he walks into the sale and tells the special commissioner, who had no authority probably to begin with, bid $244 and then keep on bidding, and if anybody else bids, just keep on bidding till you get to the full amount of the debt. I just, you know, that whole situation was created by their actions, and I don't see...
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Noonan.
Good morning. May it please the Court. James Noonan for the appellee plaintiff in the underlying action. I'd like to address some of your jurisdictional questions, which I think are germane and pertinent to this. I want to make one point that is not of the record, which is that in the lower court, after the notice of appeal had been filed, the third-party bidder asked to stay the second sale. And I filed a brief in response to that saying that the court should not stay that sale because the appellate court didn't have jurisdiction because it was not a final order. Judge Lindberg granted the motion to stay the sale, finding that it did have jurisdiction, that the sale should be stayed until the appellate court rules on this issue.
I'm getting more and more disturbed by what I'm hearing. Counsel have an ethical duty to alert this court to jurisdictional issues, and we instruct counsel in their briefs to brief them. Sometimes jurisdictional issues just slip off the radar screen. I understand that. But for you to say, I'm aware of a jurisdictional issue, we actually raised it in the district court, but I elected not to alert you to it, Seventh Circuit, in the hope that you might miss it, seems to me extraordinary.
If I may, Your Honor. The reason I felt upon review that the court did have jurisdiction is that the Baum case that came down, I believe, in 1975.
Look, I don't care what your legal conclusion is. You knew there was a potential jurisdictional problem, and you elected not to mention it in your papers in this court. You had an ethical duty to mention it. You could then tell us what your legal conclusions were.
Well, I believe
the idea of just letting it pass without notice, and maybe we would miss it, is utterly unacceptable.
Well, Your Honor, I apologize, but my reason for that is that I believe that the district court's conclusion was the right one based on the Illinois law that he considered in the case, which are the four opinions where the Illinois appellate court has allowed appeals from non-final orders in mortgage foreclosure cases. And because this case was filed under the Illinois Mortgage Foreclosure Act, I believe that was distinguishable enough from the Baum decision that this court did have jurisdiction, and I didn't address that.
Is that because there's no remedy once the sale is done? You can't rescind it? Or why is it that a foreclosure is different because the title changes and changes hands, or lots of things can go on? Because it does, one of the things in here is it does require the ultimate approval of the court.
Correct.
And that's what didn't happen. So that seems to intercept whatever, obviously if he had approved the sale, that would have been, I guess, is that final?
If the court would have approved the sale, it would have been a final order.
Yeah, so then you, I guess, get a stay pending appeal or something to keep that intact before the someone else tears down the house or whatever's on the property.
Well, I agree with Your Honor. I think if there was a final order approving the sale, that would have been proper for appellate jurisdiction purposes. Under the Illinois Mortgage Foreclosure Act was enacted in 1987, charters changed the landscape of how sales and mortgage foreclosure process occurs. And it's my understanding, based on the Illinois appellate court cases that have looked at they haven't looked at addressed the issue, but they have examined and construed and ruled upon appellate court, trial court orders vacating judicial sales or refusing to confirm judicial sales, compelling me to the conclusion that I believe it was there was jurisdiction based on that. Addressing the merits of the case, I think it's pretty clear that the standard on whether to approve or disapprove a judicial sale is an abuse of discretion standard. And
let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Richick. Is there any authority under Illinois law for the creditor to conscript the special commissioner as its agent?
No.
Is there any reason why, if this unpaid and probably illegal agent bungles the job, the remedy should fall on some other bidder as opposed to the creditor who made this move? And I can imagine saying, if you appoint somebody who under no circumstances should be your agent as your agent, then you're a fool and you lose rather than try to shift the blame to somebody else. I could understand the rule that if Illinois law makes the special commissioner an agent of the creditor, then the special commissioner, as the agent engaged in negligent behavior, would bear the blame. That's often why these agents are bonded. But, of course, the special commissioner wasn't bonded. Very hard to see why the costs of the error should be shifted to somebody else.
Well, in response to that, the reason is that that's what the Illinois Mortgage Foreclosure Act requires. It requires the court...
You can't require that because you've already told me that it doesn't permit and probably doesn't even allow the special commissioner to serve as an agent.
No. My point was, irrespective of the agency relationship to the plaintiff in the foreclosure action, the issue is whether or not, under all the circumstances, approving this sale is just or conscionable.
Let's assume you've got a good agent who goes to the auction. Right, somebody who is indisputably an employee if the creditor goes to the auction with instructions and bungles the job. What would be your best Illinois case for the proposition that the auction must be set aside and redone rather than the bungler pay some penalty?
Well, I cited a case in my brief where the attorney for the plaintiff went to the foreclosure sale and bungled it. And the court was within its means. Stack versus Cooper. It's an old case. It's 219 Illinois, 138. It's a 1905 case. The selling officer erred in accepting a bid from the mortgagor's attorney when he believed he was being submitted by the mortgagee's attorney. In that case, the court determined that under all those circumstances, this misapprehension of fact was sufficient to deny confirmation.
Which case was this again?
It's on page 7 of our brief. It's Stack versus Cooper.
Stack, okay.
But irrespective of the mistake issue, there is another basis under the law to justify a court's denial of a confirmation of a sale, which is a prejudice. And certainly here, the prejudice to the mortgagors, the Estrellas.
Mortgagor hasn't complained.
No, mortgagor hasn't complained, correct, but the prejudice to the
Nor can I imagine any prejudice. Your client has already revealed that its reservation price was $306,000, which implies that the property was worth the full amount of the debt, and it would be completely inappropriate for a judge to enter a deficiency judgment once the creditor has revealed that in its own estimation the property was worth the full amount of the debt.
Well, that's certainly not the way the practice is borne out. If no purchasers had come into the sale, that property would have went for the original opening bid amount. In that case, there would have been a deficiency. The bid instructions don't necessarily reflect the value of the property. They oftentimes reflect the value of the judgment, and oftentimes the value of the judgment could exceed the value of the property.
So you would hope somebody would bid over your ceiling, right?
Excuse me?
You would hope somebody would bid over $300,000.
Correct. Right. I mean, the value, oftentimes, the property is worth less than the judgment amount. And what oftentimes a mortgage G does in a judicial sale is to bid something significantly less than that to try to recoup as much of its investment as it can, knowing that the property at a forced sale isn't going to generate enough to satisfy the full judgment amount. So in this case, by... the higher the bid amount, the less exposure the mortgagor has to a deficiency judgment. Any further questions, I'm happy to answer. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Richard? Okay, well, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And again, I remind you that jurisdictional memos in this case are due no later than the close of business next Tuesday. We'll hear our argument in our final case of today, United States against Saladino.